You heard it right here, right now from the beat.
The new ivory is mammoth.
What do you guys want to know? I've done way too much research on dinosaurs.
Almost a larger than life figure.
No reason at all to think it was made by aliens.
Drop down and go swimming as fast as you can. Out of whale.
All these big giants, give me a kiss and tell me they don't.
The crowd, just the pop, the loudness, the excitement, the electricity.
I don't know if I can take your little Canadian destroyer.
The future is scary, but it's also wonderful.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Unscriptified podcast where genuine meets uncensored. Of course, powered by Jägermeister. Today we have the privilege of sitting down with an acclaimed cinematographer whose work has left a lasting legacy in the film industry, with a career spanning decades, whose lens has captured some of the most iconic moments in cinema. He is a visionary cinematographer who worked with the greatest and pushed the boundaries of visual storytelling. He is a true maestro of light and shadow. His portfolio includes Gladiator, Logan, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Kingdom of Heaven, and the list goes on for more than 60 titles. Grab your popcorns as we are joined by none other than 2-time Oscar-nominated cinematographer John Matheson. John, thanks for coming, and are you ready to go, Jenny, as on the screen?
Hello.
Well, it's always fun and interesting to hear the journey of great men such as you, and to get to know what made them, what shaped them, what tried to conquer them. Can you share with us how you got yourself entangled into this world of cinema and lenses?
I mean, I think everyone loves a movie, and the act of going to cinema, get away from your mundane life. Mm-hmm. And you can dream, or you get relief from your everyday dirty laundry. You get away from everything. So I was at a school. I was sent to school age 7, and they had a cinema club on Saturdays for the boys who, didn't get to go home. I didn't get at home because my father was away. My whole family was away. So they used to have a cinema every other weekend. And I mean, not that I hadn't been to cinema already, just that in the sort of horror of an English school, that you could escape for a few hours and watch a movie. So they used to show on 16mm with the projector in the room clattering away, and the terrible sound, and they'd show us boys a film, and then whatever that film was, we would play that movie for the next 2 weeks till we got there. It was Robin Hood or some aeroplane film. We'd be flying aeroplanes, or we'd be shooting arrows at each other. So that was the magic. But I didn't really know where films came from. I just thought, I don't know. I didn't know how they were made. They just were there. I think I probably wanted to be James Bond or something, but then as you get older, you start watching films that that stay with you for days on end. And interesting, like the BBC, which was the BBC Two, the smaller of the British broadcasting government broadcast, which shows French 60s Jean-Luc Godard, or the American friend Wim Wenders films, and you'd see these films in which nothing much happened, but 3 days later you were still thinking about them. But anyway, so I finished school, which was anything like this was considered to be, it wasn't even thought about at school. You had to be business, management, army, clergy. You didn't and films, as I said, films came from somewhere else. They don't know where they came from. Hollywood or some other people made them. Europeans made them. So there was no real idea that you could be consider this as a career. And I didn't think of that. But then I just fell into it, really. I met a bunch of other people who had the same sort of fascination with cinema. And we used to get together and make, and there was a film school involved that some of us went to, some of us didn't, which was really expensive and wasn't really a film course. It was just someone taking money off us. But it was a good way to meet people, and I mustn't be too cruel about it. It was a good place to go, and they did teach you basics, and you could get your hands on some 16mm equipment, some Nagras, that recorder quarter inch magnetic tape, and you can make crap little films. And that became the sort of an introduction to lots of other people, and we could then we dreamed about then one I remember one of my friends had a job as a runner on a film that was amazing. It was on a real film with real people, and we couldn't believe that he actually saw filming being made. And then we got jobs as runners and stuff like that, and working cutting rooms, which I think is very important for all filmmakers to do, especially cinematographers, and also directors too, knowing what's, because you make lots of nice shots until someone cuts them together. They don't mean anything. And then you realize that a cut works, just a simple choosing when one shot, not when the photographer thinks it should end, when the editor should think it ends, and making that cut and then joining another piece of film to it and knowing that that actually works or is smooth and has a language. And that to me was incredible, more incredible than sort of developing a picture or something, to actually see a film put together through a bunch of, shots that didn't really, they were just shots, you just join them up, you did them. When someone puts together, so to see when that lived. So that was good for me to be in cutting rooms, and I was on edge numbering, which was an early time code system of burning, Tippex white numbers onto magnetic stock and onto the film in the same place, so that when you cut the film up, you had a reference across on the in between the perforations in that gap where the film wasn't, to actually sync up and work out where a shot was. Because as you're making a film, the film gets cut and cut and cut and cut. So you had to know where those frames were. So that was one of the things I had to do, was actually number, edge number. Once the film's sunk up with a clapperboard, you would edge number them and then send them back. But again, I wasn't really getting in cutting rooms. Anyway, I was running, and I did some scenic painting. I did this, that, and the other. And I wanted to get on camera. Eventually became a sort of clapper loader. And then I did a lot of documentary stuff, news, ENG, riots, strikes, got a few black eyes from policemen and from miners. When they'd bash the camera in your face, it used to hit the viewfinder and go straight in your eye. And the one from, and also, then music videos came along. And, then they got a lot more black eyes from punks who'd punch the camera, as part of the performance. And then, just did a lot more music videos. And the punk rock movement in Britain were very much instrumental in me getting where I was. But it wasn't planned. It wasn't, I'm going to do this. I didn't know how to get into it. As I said, I didn't know where films came from. I didn't know how they were made. But then, if you're going to be a cinematographer, you better start shooting really, really soon. Don't hang around on big movie sets with big directors and think that they're going to give you, you're going to learn too much. You're not going to learn anything from fancy directors or fancy DOPs. What you're going to learn is when you do it yourself. And so I shot, I'm not sure if it's 300 or 500, probably 300 music videos. So that's what I did for many years. I did two a week, sometimes three a week sometimes. And I traveled, and there was a whole big music scene. And that, there was a big unions at the time. Unions are really unfriendly to young people trying to get in. They weren't diverse. They weren't egalitarian. They were very sort of rather, they were
boring people.
They were very right wing and red right wing newspapers, boring and made boring films, and they didn't like us. And I got in. I got given a lot of gigs by black filmmakers, by gay filmmakers. Because I was either too posh, I wasn't someone's nephew, wasn't someone's son. And anyway, the unions didn't really touch music videos. We were left to our own devices. But then you get good at them, and then I was always shooting drama and docs at the time. But then you get noticed, you get commercials, you get more money, you can show off as a DP, you do fancy shots with lots of fancy lights. And then you get noticed. But then getting into drama was another deal. You couldn't really get into drama because if you did commercials, you were ridiculous. You couldn't make commercials. And there's in England, there's a lot of weight in literature and writers and, you know, people that have studied English at Oxford. And, you know, I cannot be bothered with directors who've been and studied English. I was saying, it's got fuck all to do with filmmaking. And I was thinking, the British aren't that literate, you know. The Irish Scots are, but the English are. But the Italians are, the French are. They have a visual language. Italians in particular, they can do things with the camera. They can make sense of shots. And work. Can you guys turn it down? You're really fucking loud in my ears. You're really loud. Can you think about that? Just push the mics by the way. So coming in from, you know, more liberated and other less institutional people who hadn't had the classic education, like black people and gay, you know, guys who were more into throwing the camera around. Not the best filmmakers by any means. I mean, Derek Jarman was an appalling filmmaker, I think, and he gets given far too much credence. But, you know, he's gay and therefore everyone lauds him. But he wasn't a very good filmmaker. But there were some really good other ones going on at the time. Ex-soldiers, Nicholas Rowe, you know, Greengrass, Ken Russell, really good guys, and also the whole French thing going on. So there was and I always think if Shakespeare came back to Earth now and you said, you know, hey, Bill or William Shakespeare, you can actually make The Merchant of Venice in Venice. There's this thing called a camera. And you don't have to do all this stage and too much wordy stuff. He said, fuck me, this is good. I think his scripts will be a lot shorter. You can introduce someone by the way they look, the way they walk into the frame the first time, make an entrance in a very much Hollywood way. So I think that all came through music videos. We didn't have that structured background, and everyone laughed at us. And those are the generation of filmmakers you see now, you know. You know, we've grown old, we've grown boring, but they're the ones taking awards and stuff. But I put a lot of, in retrospect, I put a lot of weight on what happened in those early years, what happened to me, that, you know, that we did things. We didn't know. We really didn't know. But we did it 70 times. We got good at it. And, you know, you take all your crazy ideas and you realize that only 5% of them are any good, and then you perfect those. So that was the way in, I think, for me. It wasn't, I didn't go to school. I didn't study for film. I had a bunch of friends who educated me. You know, they took me to funny little cinemas. There used to be lots all over London, and we'd watch films for, like, you know, €2.50 or something. And, you know, you could, you know, and they were warm, you know, they were warmer than my apartment. You could stay there and watch films all day rather than pay for the heating bill and go home. So, I mean, am I getting a bit dark? Should I switch the lights? Can you see me okay? Yeah, should I switch lights on or not?
Yeah.
Can you see me? Yeah, okay. Anyway, so that was me getting into stuff. I, you know, as I said, it wasn't, I think, but, you know, I meet a lot of, you know, grips and people and others, you know, who everyone's got their own story, you know. No one's got, like, oh, you know, I, you know, the film business is a way of choosing you. You know, it's almost like a god comes down from the space and says you, and you know, that's it's not a recognized way in, I don't think.
Yeah, but you know, the industry.
Oh, yeah. Eh?
You have something more to say?
No, not really.
You are in the industry for decades, and you are witnessing how cinematography evolves, trends has changed, and probably. And I was the making of, for example, Percy Jackson TV series, and it with the advancement of VFX of CGI, all those camera technologies. How do you see the role of cinematographer evolves? Because everything now is basically recorded this in this augmented studio full of panels that reflects and everything. I don't know technology. Do you find that it enhances or challenges the creative process?
Well, I didn't know, you know, photography in cinema has got any better. You know, I wouldn't say that the Blade Runner from what it was, late year before last, sort of, was better than Ridley's one. You know, photographically, I'd say the first one had, especially given the time, was more, you know, had more, I believed that world. I believed, you know, I think Ridley's very good about creating worlds of, like, the future's not going to be like 2001, it's going to be gritty and dirty and greasy and all the rich people upstairs, all the poor people downstairs, where there's no atmosphere and toxic. And so, I mean, I think that film photographically conveyed that. The new one, I didn't really know where I was. I felt like it didn't really, it had felt too clean, too,
exactly.
Too, I mean, beautiful, but I didn't believe it. So, again, you know, has photography moved forward because of digital? No. You know, are the pictures better? You know, is Roger Deakins better on digital than he is on film? I don't think he is. I mourn that process of being a good film cameraman, of understanding emotion, understanding the process, understanding how to print. And you're working very much in stone. You cast the die and you were in. You know, you worked in real concrete things, and you know, you didn't fiddle around with it later or soften it off or build windows or stabilize or even cut people out entirely and put them somewhere else. That wasn't, you know, you had to know your stuff, and you had to also know your stuff photochemically. You had to understand chemicals. I mean, not too much, making it sound too like black magic. But they certainly, you know, the old photographers with the big black velvet gun over your head and held, you know, watch the thing click. You know, there's a certain amount of magic in photography that that was always respected, even though there might have been a whole lot of bluffers behind it who were like full of shit talking stuff. But you did actually, you were responsible for the negative. That tiny little thing, you know, this little thing like that. And there's no problem projecting white. It's actually trying to create good black. So when you have something that small, you're blowing up something the size of half a tennis court, you've got to get that thing to a really good place where you're exposing it beautifully, but you're making the blacks hard enough, you're suppressing the grain, you're understanding how to balance that to get the best out of this analog image you can. And that was, Evan, you know, talk about it. It's a craft, it was a skill, call it an art form, but actually just understanding the photochemical side or getting to know yourself. And, you know, you had light meters, but you had your eye is the thing you trusted. Now you turn up in a set and everything's, you know, cameras see everywhere, there's too much latitude, there's green screens everywhere, which, you know, I can teach any idiot to light a green screen for 20 minutes. No, really, I mean, it's not mysterious. I remember Seamus McGarvey and I had a girlfriend or friend, girl, whatever, and she told us, and she was a cinematographer, she told us she'd never shot green screen, and we both looked at her with absolute, you know, unbelief. We couldn't believe she said that. Anyway, we both told her how to light green screen in about 5 minutes, and she looked at us and said, is that it? Well, yeah, you know, that's it. So you don't really, the higher you go in the food chain, the less you have to know. You know, I've said this before, I could turn up drunk on a big shoot and someone would look up exposure, the green screen would be lit. You know, when you're on the smaller films, you have to be more resourceful. If you're on a smaller film and shooting film, you better have your wits about you. You better be really on your game. And you better not get drunk the night before, and you better understand your eyes. You better understand what you see. You better doubt everything. You better doubt your light meter. You better look in through the frame and actually think, is this it? Is this where I want to balance this shot? Where's the key turn? Where's my highlight? Where's the bottom end? Am I stretching it too much? Actually, I don't want the audience to see over there. I want to make that black. You don't do any of those things on digital. None of them.
You mentioned now, obviously, about Dickens and about digital versus film, things that you spoke about. And I actually listened to Quentin Tarantino, who I think still insists on filming on film or recording on film. Do you feel, because I get the feeling sometimes, you know, watching these movies that are heavily CGI, that they look almost too real, like, and therefore they look fake. Do you get that feeling for the audience, maybe, that, you know, we are just making something that looks too perfect, so to speak?
I don't know if I'd describe it as perfect. I think it's, I don't know, it's difficult to say what's baked into our minds or what we think an aesthetic is. You know, why you think the colors or the resolution is more pleasant on film, even though that's grainy and it flickers. And, but I do find the colors more sophisticated on film. You know, in digital, they seem to gravitate towards the primaries really quickly. So if you had a poppy red, like a red with oranges in it, it might go very much towards a Guardsman red or the color of a British phone box or British telephone box or a post box or a British Guardsman outside Buckingham Palace. It'll go super. So it's difficult to muck things up. Things look, things clean up. I just don't think digital cameras or electronic images, let's call it, video, because that's what it used to be fucking called. And they give it this fancy name. It's by Turbo. Remember Turbo came out? You could buy Turbo sunglasses. Very difficult to buy sunglasses with a petrol injection in them. To, you know, it was everywhere. So, you know, but it's still an electronic camera. I mean, I wasn't allowed to shoot on film when I started. I shot a lot of Sony 3000s, Betacam SPs. You know, we shot on tape. But still, the camera, the front end, still had the same problems they have now. Sony's about the Red, Ikigami did this, Panasonic did that. So whether it's that or whether you associate it with, I don't know, cheap television, news crews, or whether you prefer the colors, which I do, because I think Kodak, by the end of it all, were very good at getting those dyes to stick on the celluloid to make an image that you found pleasing. Now, whether that was right or too real, as you called it, if you shoot it digitally, I don't know. But I do feel more comfortable, but I'm thrilled this year that most of the films, that, whether they're good or bad or whatever, that going for awards for shot on film, there seems to be this I don't know. I mean, you know, do you like coffee? Do you like tea? You know, nothing wrong with digital. I just don't like it. It doesn't do anything for me. It hasn't really made my films any better photographically. I hate it when it's outside. I hate it when it's cloudy. You can't do anything with it. Inside, yeah, you can light it. You can do this, you do that. I just don't. And also, I don't like everybody else joining in and telling you what to do. Monitors all over the set. You know, no one used to come out and sit in a laboratory out near the airport in London at 7 o'clock in the morning and grade films in smelly laboratories with guys in brown lab coats smelling of ammonia and vinegar. And, you know, oh, you come to Soho and have a bit of lunch and sit around. Would you like an espresso? Or do you want the Wi-Fi code? No one. You know, you go out then, you know, so I'll come along 11. The guys will say, no, you'll be at 7 in the morning, eyes open, looking at the film, and it would fly through that projector at speed. And you had to call the shots really fast. What was wrong with them? I mean, you had to be really concentrate. And, you know, to grade a film would take you about a week. Now to DI a film, I mean, I like to work pretty quick. Like, it's a piece of music, I like to get through it in about, I mean, you leave me alone, I'll do it in a week, but, you know, you give me 10 days with the director. Or, you know, just over a week. Some people spend 6 weeks, 8 weeks in there. And at the end of it all, you look at it and go, is that it? And is that what you were doing there all that time? You know, I think the boldness of film, the boldness of exposure, which gave us cinematographers different identities, you could tell that, you know, someone was behind the lens when you've got a really good-looking film. You know, there's no difference when if I shoot a big Marvel film, there's no difference between me and Cameron and Mugabe and Ben Davis, it all is the same. It's all been treated. It all goes to the thing. It's just not, you know, and you say, if you like that, fine. But I wouldn't say it's got better. I wouldn't say, and I think, as I said, I think the shame of the new service rockers coming up, you won't find the ones that can really look, because they'll get lost in the melee of all the others, because there's so many things to help you. As I said, I could turn up drunk on a set and it would all happen around me.
Yeah. You've been...
I mean, that might sound really callous, but it's true. If I turned up drunk with a light meter on celluloid, the film would be lost. Everything rested on you. Everything, you know. If you had a cold, or if you weren't feeling right, you had a row with your girlfriend or something, it all came out in the rushes, or the dailies, as people call them. So I miss that process. My daughter, weirdly, I was helping her today. I was being an electrician, a spark. I mean, those lights are heavy, man. I forgot how heavy they were. I burnt my fingers.
You are the cinematographer here.
Yeah, I know, but I was helping her. But she, anyway, she likes to shoot with constant light. And so I stole some lights from Panelux. Thank you very much, Panelux. And I was like, I lit them for her. But she shoots on film. She used to say, when she said, is that one of the films with the funny colors? When she was about 5 or 6 years old. I mean, not that she, I don't think she could be a cinematographer. But she could tell when colors weren't right. I mean, kids are fantastic. They're always painting and using all sorts of colors. But she didn't like some of the animation. She didn't like some of the films that were badly DI'd or were shot on digitally. And then she went towards film. I mean, I bought her this camera, a very nice camera, you know, Panelux Lumix thing. And she told me there was something wrong with it. I looked at it. I couldn't find anything wrong with it. She said, oh, it's wrong. And she said, what's that? I said, well, that on the shelf, that's an old Nikon. Oh, well, give me, and one of those things you should know about this. You know, she shot it. It's orange, you know, that's the name. And then you have to pay for it. You have to get it printed. It's expensive. I said, oh, just plug it into the computer. And so our photography got a lot better, a lot quicker than it would have done if you just carried on. But that was her decision. I did not push her that way. But she has an eye, an aesthetic, and a feeling for things that are to do with that. I mean, I just think film's more sophisticated, ultimately. I just think it's got better colors, better. I mean, resolution is certainly other. I mean, I just did this big ABBA thing that you hear about, a big thing. And, you know, we tested the cameras with ILM and we chose the Red, which is the best camera in the world because it had amazing resolution. Resolution has never really interested me that much. It's more the feeling of course, you've got to get sharp and good and you want to enjoy the cinema experience. But it's the colors that I've always liked and drawn me to painting, to interiors, to different cultures, the way they, you know, the dyeing of an East African shawl will be different to the way it is in deep South Africa or into West Africa. So why is there this color? This red is not the same as that red. I do feel that film captures that better. You know, you've got these lights now that very clever lights that, you know, they make in various countries, particularly Sputnik in Estonia. And they say, well, we're only going to make exposure for the wavelengths the camera sees. And that kind of makes sense. Why put energy and power into something? But you think, well, what's missing? And if you look at a color arc of a film, or a bit of Kodak film, it's like this. So you look at a digital one, there's no red, comes in, spikes up a blue, drops down, no cyan. Cyan's a big problem, rises up again, green, and falls down. You have to synthesize the colors, pull them. Whereas a film block is like that. And that's pretty much what your eye sees as well. So, you know, without going into the science of it all, as I said, ultimately, there's nothing wrong with digital at all. But do you like coffee? Do you like tea? And
yeah.
I think if I was a young cinematographer now, well, I wouldn't be. I'd open a bar or something. It wouldn't have the allure or the interest or that mystery that I had to learn and get. And it was good. You know, you get good numbers from the laboratory. They rang up and, you know, Kodak had it, or other, well, Fuji 2 had exposure levels of 25 across the band, which was a bit too low. Allows you to, so you were looking for about 30, 33, 32. So if you hit 100 on your printing lights, you actually felt good. Someone rang you up and gave you 27, yeah, 31, yeah, 32. And you go, oh, fantastic. Someone read you, they'd read you three numbers on the telephone and you get excited. You didn't have to see it. You were in Morocco or somewhere in Africa and they rang up. They said, that means you'd hit the exposure exactly where you wanted it to be.
Yeah, cool.
So that's kind of not gone, but, you know. So that's one of the big differences, I think. When I started, you had to, that's all there was. There were no video films, as I call them, digital films.
Well, you collaborated with various directors and actors. Can you maybe, including Guy Ritchie or Vaughn, Mangold, of course, Ridley Scott, and can you maybe share a particular memorable or challenging collaboration?
And you know, I read that in some cases, some directors are on hands. They are, you know, maybe a little bit of control freaks, and some give a total freedom to their cinematographer. Is there cases like that for you as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's the ones who really don't know or don't want to. They don't, like I say, a lot of the English directors don't actually really know, or they want you to take care of that. Doesn't mean they're not involved, but they don't know how to achieve it. And then the ones who think they know, when they tell you what to do, and you go very politely, you say, yeah, yeah. And not to undermine them, you just do it the way you think, well, you know, I know what you're saying, but this is the better way to do it. And, you know, you usually might have a fight on the set, but in the end of the day, they go, oh, that's the best sequence we did. Oh, the best sequence we did, really? Okay. So, and they're the ones who think they know, have a little knowledge, and that can be a dangerous thing. But of course, you know, now with digital, you can't really argue. There it all is. Yeah. You don't like it? Fine, we'll do something else. But it, you know, I don't get into it to. I think about it very deeply. I think about the script, the characters, how to make an entrance, the color arc of a film. What's the film do? Does it have a mood that goes up and down? You know, or just you know, do some cool shit to make it like some sort of fragrance commercial all the way through. You know, I don't want to do that. You want to travel. So you know, I think about what each character means to all. Not to give them a signature color, but when something like musical, something like Doctor Strange, you can, but you're trying to, you know, tell the story without. I mean, it was interesting when I used to make films. We'd go to the laboratory and the guys in coats in the morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, they would tell you if you made a good film or not, because, you know, they're just working the pictures, no sound. They never work the sound to the last possible minute. And they would tell you, and then sometimes two of them would argue and say, it was, and they'd come to me like a referee and say, John, does when he goes to her, does she say this or does he say that because that's happened? And I said, no, Barry, she knew that already. And the other guy would say, I told you so. And they'd worked out the movie before they'd heard me sound. So that was always a good sign if they'd worked out the film and thought the film was good. So, you know, those guys I'd listen to more about the what they thought about it than some of the directors I worked with, because they'd tell me if they made a good film or not. And invariably they were right, because they saw a lot of films. And that was the wonderful thing about going to a laboratory. You could actually get John Alcott's grader. You could get, you know, Janusz Kaminski's guy, because you know, the lab guys didn't give a shit. You know, now you go to the West End or up in Hollywood, you get these rock and roll kind of DI guys, you know, who come in with loud music and, you know, white sofas. Lots of pretty people running around bringing espressos with a twist of lemon and, you know, all that sort of crap. But these were working guys. You know, you go in and you get a shit cup of tea and a horrible white sandwich, a bit undercooked bacon in it. But they really knew film. And Hollywood, too, one or two great graders in Hollywood. Really good. They never got the recognition they should have done. So, yes, you had directors who were very vocal, ones who just said, look, make it look marvelous. Ones who thought they knew. and ones you can really talk with. You know, you look at some of the films this year. You know, Robbie Ryan and Jürgen's Poor Things. You know, a real collaboration. You can tell. You know, if a DP is going to take a jump off a cliff, and the director said, "I'll go with you. I'll hold your hand. Let's do this thing." That's when you see a great collaboration. You know, you get films that look nice. You know, that's always a bad sign when someone comes out of cinema and says, "Oh, John, it looked nice." It's all very well making nice. You know, it means that no one, "Oh, it looked nice" is a polite way of saying, "You did your thing, but the film's a disaster." You want, you know, so that was a failure. I feel that's a failure on my part. You know, maybe because I didn't communicate enough, or maybe I couldn't. But if you don't make a film that you're all pointing, pushing the same way, you can have fights, you can do this. As long as you all go this way and you haven't got people going this way or just someone stopping, you're all pushing that way. Costume, hair, makeup, production design, very important, assistant director, all going that way, all going to take a jump off the cliff. That's a great thing. And I saw that a lot this year in this year's films. I thought some really bold films. Maestro is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I've seen some really bold photography, design, and good direction, you know, using their cinematographers and their design guys to trust and let them free and to do some big stuff.
One of the works that I love from you is Logan. Often praised. Also Mangold is a great director in my opinion. Fantastic. Blending these elements of superhero genre with Western and character-driven drama. It has a distinct visual style, and even the noir version that later came, different from typical superhero stuff. You worked on other stuff like Detective Pikachu and Doctor Strange, which look nice. But can you elaborate on the creative decision made to give this film a unique look and atmosphere it had?
Well, Logan. You mean Logan or?
Yeah, I know Logan. Logan.
Yeah, well, Logan, I mean, Logan was sort of, you know, I mean, I didn't want to do it. It's a superhero film. This producer friend of mine, he kept bringing me to come and I was like, it's not for me. And he said, so he sent me the script, read the script. All right, I'll read the script. And then he rang me back and said, what do you think? I said, you know, it's not for me. He said, you haven't read it. I said, well, no, I didn't. There's an edit. He said, read it. So I read it. And then they kill him. I said, we're going to kill a superhero? I said, are you going to kill one? I said, a long fucking last. Let's fucking get rid of him. Let's start with this guy. This kid. So I said, I'm in. So I went over and met James. And said, oh, marvelous. Shot the movie. And, of course, then I meet Hugh Jackman, and he was really irritating. He's incredibly charming. He knows everyone's name. He never curses. He never loses his shit. He's really good at dancing. He's got nice legs, and all the girls love him. He's really irritating. So, we did kill him, and that was great. But he wanted to make a film that was toxic. You know, the guy's dying. Didn't want to do beautiful desert scenes, you know, all rolling hills, sunset. You know, make it really hot and horrible. And he lives in a toxic place, and the desert's burnt out. I wanted to make it look like a 70s film like Easy Rider or, just sort of driving film, two-lane blacktop, some really hard traveling road movie. I say he lives in an old warehouse that it was, you know, they made some nasty thing in it. So Jackman, you know, that Logan is dying and, you know, they're all washed up. These guys are played out. They're finished. So that was, you know, it's a toxic film. It's a sad film. And, you know, when they kill him, it's great. But I think it was, but then the monochrome thing was bullshit. And, you know, I'd worked very hard on going to those sage deserts and that burnt look and the yellows and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Leica gave James Mangold a beautiful big medium format camera, which was black and white, and he was trying to work it, and I was doing some makeup tests. I said, hey, give me that thing. I pushed my camera out of the way, and I shot these portraits of Patrick Stewart and Hugh, and they went on, you know, the IMDb thing. It's just, you know, it's portrait. They're very nice. I mean, the camera's incredible because you haven't got 3 pixels. You just got black and white, and it's an amazing camera. I mean, I was hoping to get a free one, but they didn't give me anything, James. But it was a beautiful camera with incredible detail, this fine, fine, because you, instead of having 3 pixels, you got one, you know, black or white, you know, just that's what it does. So the resolution's beyond, the depth is beyond, the velvetness. So shot these features, and they, that became this thing, and I don't know what happens, you know, these superhero geek people, they said it should be a black and white version, which I know had nothing to do with. I mean, it was just rubbish. I hated the fact they did that. You know, I worked really hard on getting those color separations of, you know, the sagey desert was a yellow toxic thing, and the sunsets that weren't too pretty, and then someone's, and you know, his flesh tones and those rusty interiors. You know, someone just, and so my producer, the one who got me into it, said, "Come on, we're going to kill a superhero." You know, I was at a Q&A thing, and it was all very fancy and full of, you know, marble morons. And someone said,
"You're insulting us currently."
Yeah, well, I don't care. he said, this question came up about the black and white, and Joe just took the microphone off me and said, "Doy you, go to your TV, find the chroma button, turn it left. Next question." You know, it was just bullshit. I mean, the idea that you graded this, like, if you want to shoot black and white, shoot black and white. I will separate it. I will give you layers. I'll give you tonal separation. If I'm working on color separation, within those, the tones of those color separations play secondary colors against primaries and those secondaries against second secondaries. Do not take my fucking work and stamp on it.
But, yeah, understandable. Understandable.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's bullshit. It's bullshit. Everyone gets excited. It was all because I took 3 pictures on a very fancy Leica camera, but I was shooting black and white. I lit those for black and white. I didn't do it.
I remember the first picture from Logan, promotional, was black and white.
That's correct.
Yeah. So there's the one.
No, I think they, you know, the marketing and things, they did things very cleverly. You know, they were, you know, if you want a really good portrait of someone, it's a really interesting thing to do black and white, especially if someone is of a certain age, they've seen a few things, they've got a lot of history in their face. And, you know, that's the character of Logan, certainly the character of Patrick Stewart. Yeah, you know, that was, you know, he's been around, he's old, but everyone's old, they're all, you know, and they're really great pictures. And, you know, and I remember talking to Patrick, "What you're doing," and sort of doing these really intense sort of black and white, like Duffy and David Bailey, and he knew exactly what I was talking about, a generation of British.
Yeah, it reminded me.
Protopus. Yeah, and I said, "Oh, okay. And he did something. He kind of leaned into me, and he looked at me through the top of his eyebrows. You know, he kind of, I don't know, did the 60s thing or something. But, you know, you do things differently if you're working in black and white. I mean, if someone said to me the other day, they saw a version of Indiana Jones, you know, Dougie Slocum, which he lit for Spielberg when he was something like 80 years old. And they said he saw a black and white version. They said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "No, it worked really well because that's where Slocum came from. He worked on layers of contrast and light and hard light and trying to separate dark things towards you and then, you know, keeping things brighter behind." And they said it worked quite well. I said, "Oh, you know, quite interesting." But if you were trying to make this a much more delicate film with delicate colors, and you know, let's say, Romeo and Juliet or something like that, made by, you know, then that would be lost. You know, you need color separation, you need delicate tones, even though they're not might be bright. You need that. So if you want to shoot black and white, shoot black and white. If you don't.
Yeah, you were also involved in another superhero project, Batgirl, and it's 90 meter shelf in a box. Are you happy it won't see the light of day, or is there something that we will miss from it?
No, I mean, it's your tragic. I mean, Well, no, I mean, she, I mean, it was friendship, but Leslie, I mean, she was great, this girl. I mean, she's, you know, she made it really kind of funny. I mean, I feel terrible for her, you know, the young actress, be addressed as. I feel awful for her because she worked really hard, and she was like, you know, she's Commissioner Gordon's daughter, and her dad's a bit old, and she's trying to look out for him, and he's got a bit of history, and his career hasn't ended too well, and she's trying to defend him, and, you know, and then these things turn up, this bad guy turns up, some from his past, and she's got this boyfriend who's a really nice guy, but she likes him, they have a date night, but they're really boring. Then she's got this transsexual person who really fancies her, and she likes her a lot, but she doesn't really want her attention. Then she fancies the gangland boss's son, who's actually a bit like Michael in the first Godfather. He's still a good guy, and she's in love with him, but the trans girl guy wants after him, and the boyfriend doesn't know what's wrong. But dad's wondering who this redhead girl running around town is, and she's trying to fix everything. It was funny, and she was totally endearing. And it was a really greasy film we made on the streets. There was no blue screen. The guys wanted to do models. They wanted to do models, real stuff, real thing. We had Eaton in it. It was good. I mean, but then they got bit. The film was, you know, needed some attention. You know, it wasn't the best. But what was good about it, it had a real feel about it. It was really in the streets in Glasgow, which is a greasy, horrible, old, depressing town. At winter, with snow and rain and... I mean, it looked good, you know, Gotham's fucked, and you know, they need heroes. It's just everything was going downhill. And perfect background. No studio work, really. And then Warner's got taken over by Disney, and then I don't know what happens. You know, in that American thing, if someone comes in as CEO, I'll just take that over. Everyone keeps their job. They come and they fire everybody, and they kill projects. And it got killed or got taken. It was told it wasn't suitable, this side or the other. I mean, Warner's UK were furious. You know, they weren't on this sort. It's very much the American way of taking over a company and killing other things. You know, it sort of happened with George Lucas and Paramount back in the day, and George Lucas managed to nick the rights to Star Wars, and didn't they regret that when they got taken over? And so, you know, but there is this thing of just the axe comes down, and that's what killed it. I mean, it needed some work, and it was nearly there. And we were talking about, you know, picking up some shots, changing a little bit of the narrative here and there, but nothing much, you know. I didn't think it would have been the best, but it was a very different film. It was very different. It felt very real. It felt about this girl who was totally endearing and lovely, but just always screwing everything up, but trying to do the right thing by everybody else, you know. She's trying to save everyone. She wasn't like this big, sort of muscular, you know, Captain America thing. She was just this, and then she had this secret life, you know, and then trying to look after her dad and look after her boyfriend, and you know, it was good. And I don't know where, but I mean, they did kill it. It is gone. They picked up everything, every storyboard, every frame, everything went into the incinerator. I don't know. It's rather sad. I mean, well, you know, even if it, you know, you just to throw, you know, you build the house, you build, and then you just set fire to it, burn it down, you think, well, did they live in it?
At least you can have insurance. Yeah.
Well, that was what it was part of. It's sort of a tax write-off. They could do it as part of it. I mean, it's just obscene. I mean, that's, you know, you hear straight, well, business, American business, and the way American business goes sometimes, and, look at that fantastic businessman, Donald Trump. He's a destroyer of things, you know. And I think he's been very bad for America. I think some really bad decisions have permeated down from the top man. You know, if the man at the top is no good, then everybody else just runs around and really behaves very badly too. I mean, I just think it was...
They are on the street.
Well, yeah. I mean, anyway, I don't know what happened there. But it's sad. We did some good stuff in it. You know, really good... Gothic-y, kind of modern. But I say it was real, you know. Yeah. The guys who had this show on film, they were very into like shooting models, very into old style effects. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm burning to ask you about Gladiator 2, but let's look at a few words. Obviously, you're returning one of the most legendary films ever, and 24 years later, you're going to do the sequel. You know, first of all, how do you feel about first? Because I know you told us that you returned from the production and some reshoots are being spoken. How do you feel now about The Gladiator 2? And what is the, you know, difference, obviously, 24 years later? How does the filming feel just of the sequel of that legendary film?
Well, the film, I mean, you know, the sets are the same, exactly the same. We rebuilt it all. Obviously now, there's a lot more action. I think that's just the way films are expected to be, you know, maybe people want more, you know, the whole Marvel thing. They, from Born This, for Born This to Born That, you know, Born Identity, the way people film things, to people want, well, they think they want more action. I don't know if they do. I think, you know, as I said, this year's Academy Award nominations, the BAFTA ones, have really slowed that down a bit. And I, you know, hopefully we might be seeing the end of all these Marvel films where people just throw people through walls for half an hour and it sort of gets them up and lasers come out of their eyes and they're all dead. But there is this pressure that's probably come on to that. Well, there's this pressure that's come on to those sort of films to make, maybe that's influenced Gladiator. It's not quite as, I can't really tell you too much about it because we're still filming it. So I'm not really how to speak about it. So obviously it's digital, which is, that, as you just heard, not so great for me. So ultimately, I don't think I will like it, or some people might not like it as much as the original. But then again, it's going to be very difficult to hold up this against an original film because it was so, I mean, even when we made it, people didn't even know when we made it that it would be such a well-received film, and people love that film. People have seen it 20 times, 30, you know, people just know every line in the movie. None of us knew that it was going to be, well, especially me, maybe it was just me, I didn't know that it was going to be this huge success, or this just go into like the, you know, into the very fabric of all what we think cinema is, knitted into the history of it all. They've been obviously talking about it for many years. I don't want to spoiler though. I don't want to tell you anything really though.
Fair enough. That's good for us for out. John, obviously thank you for I know we are now short on time, so I want to thank you for being our guest.
Before
we wrap up, I have one more thing to tell you. You should change your picture on IMDb profile.
Trust me.
Well, put that should change.
Why? I'm invisible. I don't do social media. I don't mind talking to you. I don't like talking to
you. Google yourself. Google yourself.
Well, I've got other stuff to do.
That's more interesting.
Yeah, I'll send you a photo. But you know, you wouldn't mind it changing it because it's not representative.
It's not you on that picture.
Yeah.
Because what you see in the thumbnail is two other contenders for the
Oscars. Yeah, so, you know, it's not
representative. Did they win?
Yes.
Well, then that's more interesting.
Better than you go.
Yeah. Well, back to
Before we wrap up, we have one more tradition, a little bit of tradition on this podcast, where we say a quote in our language and translate it to English. And for this time, I chose a quote from our famous director, Živko Nikolić. And on our language, he said, "Često se čudim kad vidim se koliko jede I žuči ljudi prihvate film ili knjigu ili bilo koje drugo umjetničko djelo, kako to doživljavaju kao nešto što je konačno I definitivno. Umjetnost je samo igra. Mnogo dalje od toga ne treba ići." And on English it will translate to, "I'm often surprised when I see with how much seriousness people accept movie or book or any other work of art, how they experience it as something that is final and definitive. Art is just a game. You don't need to go much further than that."
one of
don't talk horseshit.
Thank you for joining us, and thank you for...
Okay, guys. Take care. Nice to talk to you.
We stay genuine, uncensored, and unscripted, and we always will, as we have to order our usual. Share us and subscribe us, and stay tuned until the next Wednesday.
Iguzo!